Hello, welcome to the New Stack Makers, a podcast where we talk about at-scale application development, deployment, and management.
Hello, welcome to the latest edition of the New Stack Makers podcast from the New Stack. For this episode, we're going to do a deep dive into Web3. What is Web3 all about? We've been hearing a lot about Web3 and its promise of decentralization, how it will bring the power of the web back to the people through the use of blockchain and other distributed technologies. And there's a lot of hype on both sides about the value, but we want to kind of delve into the Web3.0 stack. What is the Web3.0 stack? What can you build with the Web3.0 stack? And how far along are we of tooling and ease of use? For this episode, we have three guests, each from a different company pioneering important work in the Web3.0 community. From the Interchain Foundation, we have Marko Borisovic. From Agoric, we will be speaking with Roland Gross. And finally, from Protocol Labs, who's done a lot of interesting work around the interplanetary file system, the file system of record for Web3.0, we have Dietrich Yala. Did I get that right? Probably not.
Close enough. Thanks.
All right. Let's go with that. Anyway, so let's jump in. First, we'll talk a bit about each of these companies and what technologies they are offering. And then after that, we'll kind of sum it up and talk about how software developers, Web2.0 or just software developers can jump into the Web3.0 application building. First, let's start with Roland with Agoric. Agoric, on the website it says it offers a proof of stake chain utilizing secure JavaScript smart contracts to rapidly build and deploy decentralized finance, applications. Yeah, so let's unwrap that a bit. What is a proof of stake chain and what can it be used for?
Sure. And thanks for having me on here. And I see that, given myself and the other two guests, we have different representatives from different parts of the stack. And, I think for proof of stake, Marko probably does more work directly on that layer than Agoric does. But what we are is sort of a consumer of a lot of the work that is done on the lower levels for how blockchain consensus actually operates. And what Agoric provides is a smart contract framework and tools for developers to actually deploy user-facing applications. And we rely on a whole bunch of the work that is done by others in the ecosystem, including the guests that we have here, to be able to accomplish that. And so to explain a proof of stake chain briefly, proof of stake uses the actual economic value of the blockchain itself for security. So whereas if you're familiar with Bitcoin and mining and Ethereum and mining right now, really the way security comes into those chains is by electricity effort, really to solve complex puzzles in order to sort of solve the puzzle first and add the next block to the chain. And I'm simplifying greatly there. In a proof of stake chain, we get rid of the electricity required for mining, and it's really around how much economic value is secured to allow the next block to be produced and to have everyone come to consensus on it. With the idea being, if somebody puts a block in that has something that is incorrect or invalid, there's actually a significant economic penalty for them to do that, and therefore they're incentivized not to. Obviously, we can go into a lot more detail there, but Agoric is a blockchain that actually requires this consensus mechanism to be able to do all the other stuff that we do at the higher levels of the stack.
Whoa, so you can actually do a blockchain, but not burn up electricity and servers then with this approach.
And that is part of the idea, yeah. And, if you look at the original Ethereum white and yellow papers, this was part of their plan from the beginning to transition. And the Cosmos ecosystem, which evolved around the same time, frankly, has been pushing this vision for a long time. If you look at most modern blockchains, they are looking at proof of stake as the primary way to secure the chain. And, obviously there are proponents for proof of work as well and why that is important. So it truly is a choice with trade-offs versus a strictly better thing. But we believe it's the right trade-off.
How do you prove stake? in this scenario?
Yeah. So the way it works in the Cosmos ecosystem is sort of a form of delegated proof of stake, where as a user, you hold tokens in the chain, and you can delegate them to specific validators, which are running the node software that is required to validate transactions and make sure that blocks move forward. As a regular user that's not running a node, I pick from a selection of validators that are offering this service, and the top 100 or 150 validators or so end up being part of the chain to validate blocks. And so that way, as a user, theoretically, I'm able to assess the validator's capability to do this correctly and delegate my stake to validators that I trust for one reason or another. And if I find that a validator is misbehaving, I can move my stake to some other validator. And that's how we sort of limit the number of nodes that are participating in the network such that the network can function quickly, but also allow everybody to contribute their own value to securing the chain.
Nice, nice. How did Agoric get started? What was the original motivation?
Yeah, Agoric predates blockchain by several decades, actually. Really, and I'm speaking for other people here, as I've been part of the company for the last 15 months, but if you look back at A16Z's canon for smart contracts, some of the papers there were the Agoric smart contract papers that were written by Mark Miller and a few others back in the late 80s. And really, the goal there was trying to understand how you can have economic cooperation between distributed computing agents. And you can model a blockchain as actually just a single computer, right? A blockchain is a computer that is made out of consensus from multiple people, and actually, yes, Thousands of people. And so the Agoric vision predates blockchain, but blockchain enables it in a way that really was difficult to do prior to its launch. So what Mark Miller and folks were trying to figure out was, how do you have economic cooperation between computing agents? Well, that also requires sort of an economic currency that you can use to pay for execution and all that stuff. Prior to Bitcoin and prior to value being able to be scarce on the internet, it was difficult to do that. And so blockchain works extremely well into Agoric's vision, but Agoric's vision also expands, you know, beyond just blockchains to other individual computing agents, cross-chain communication and all that stuff as well.
Nice, nice. Now, there's going to be a lot of stupid questions from me in this episode, just as I'm getting up to speed. But overall, what role do smart contracts play in the ecosystem to help developers build their distributed apps? Why are smart contracts important?
Yeah, I think about this in a couple of ways. One is, to me, what's really new about this system from an entrepreneur's perspective, and not just a developer, but somebody looking to build and deploy a business, is that if you launch a smart contract onto a blockchain, you can be assured that as long as that chain is still running, your contract is still functioning and anyone can call its public functions. And that gives you a level of security around, you're effectively deploying a perpetual program, right? So what people have figured out, Ethereum launched, and in the 2016-2017 timeframe, it got a lot of attention, and there was a lot of difficulty in sort of understanding, okay, we think that this thing is cool, but we don't really know exactly what we can do with it yet. And there was a lot of infrastructure that had yet to be built and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. In the 2020 timeframe, 2021 timeframe, you started to see applications succeed that effectively coordinated actions of individuals with the knowledge that there is this perpetual program running on chain that can be accessed by anybody from anywhere and can't be stopped. Right. And because of that knowledge, it enables new kinds of things that really couldn't have existed before. And so I think that you're starting to see success in a bunch of user-facing applications that are using that capability. And that's sort of where things have come in the last couple of years. And I think we're really just still scratching the surface of what can be done there. And it's a little bit of a vague answer, but I think high level, that's how I think about it.
Terrific, terrific. And just the level set, Ethereum can be thought of as a virtual machine server for the blockchain. Is that a good way of describing that?
Yeah, and there is the Ethereum virtual machine. And so similarly, Agoric has a virtual machine that we're launching that's in JavaScript and executes differently, and there are competing other VMs as well. But yes.
Terrific. And finally, for Gork, you say it can be used in decentralized finance or DeFi. Can you talk a bit about what your customers or what your potential customers are using it for?
Yeah. And so we start to get into things that are a little bit specific to what has happened so far in the blockchain space over the last couple of years. But okay, what you've seen, I mentioned before that you're starting to see user level applications that are getting success based on this knowledge that a program can perpetually execute and everyone knows how it will execute because you can see the code. And that has driven so much success so far with networked finance applications. And so, you know, coordinating one group of users that have one set of needs with another group of users that have a complementary set of needs, and you start to see network effects grow. What has been difficult so far is doing that quickly and securely. Building and launching an Ethereum, a DeFi application on Ethereum, requires a lot of security training. It requires a deep understanding of common issues in Ethereum. And even experts get it wrong frequently, you know, and if you follow the right people on Twitter, every couple of weeks, there's some multi-deca-million-dollar hack or something like that that happened from well-meaning people and good engineers that just made a mistake or didn't model something properly. And what Agoric is really trying to solve is making that more straightforward. And we do that by building in specific security mechanisms, which I won't go into here, but it's really around how do you ensure that exchange of value is guaranteed by the underlying system versus developer written code. So it avoids large classes of bugs that developers would otherwise have to worry about. And then also making code more truly composable. So right now, code copying in smart contract writing really is copy pasting into your own repo. And then suddenly, you know, you're out of date, or you had a typo, or you made a modification because you thought it'd be okay. And you've invalidated all of the audits that have gone through that kind of copying or that code previously. Agoric is working to make it possible to import modules into your smart contract system and understand clearly how they would interact with the value that's coming in and out of that system so that you can be a little bit more secure doing that. So really, we think that what we have is a strong system that will allow developers to build on top of each other much more rapidly and with a lot more peace of mind.
Nice, nice. All right, fantastic. Let's find out a little bit more about Protocol Labs. I know Protocol's helped us out on a number of early Web3.0 stories for the new stack. Dietrich, my understanding is, well, you guys offer two major technologies, the Interplanetary File System and Filecoin. And first, very interested about Interplanetary File System, IPFS. How does a file system work in the context of Web3.0?
Yeah, that's a great question. I joined Protocol Labs a couple of years ago to explore exactly that. IPFS is what kind of pulled me into the project. Now learning lots more about complementary technology Filecoin that you mentioned, as well as a third one probably worth mentioning, which a number of other projects use in the space, called LibP2P, and is a network stack that both IPFS and Filecoin built on itself. What does a file system mean in the context of Web3? I feel like sometimes it's helpful to compare it to HTTP, talk about what the differences are. IPFS is what we call a content-addressed file distribution protocol. So it's a way of addressing data no matter where it is on the network. IPFS addresses things by the unique signature of the data that you put on the network. So you take a photo that you took, and you publish it to HTTP. You would upload it to a server, and you would reference that photo by the domain name of that server, followed by possibly a path to the name of that file or its location. With IPFS, you would publish a file to the network by adding it to your IPFS node or a commercially hosted IPFS node, and then you would address that data, you would reference it by the signature, and this is simplifying a little bit, but generally by the signature of that set of bits that comprises that file itself. That means a couple of interesting things can happen. One, you can cryptographically verify that the file that you get when you ask for something is actually what you asked for. And this is really unique because in HTTP, you can ask for the same thing multiple times and different sets of bits can be returned. We really refer to this as dynamic content in HTTP. But with IPFS, if you ask for something by that address, you will always get a verifiable set of bits that you can confirm are the actual thing you asked for. The second interesting thing that it means is that when you can verify that what you asked, what you get is actually what you asked for, you don't have to care where it comes from anymore. It can come from any of the servers that are willing to provide it to you. And that is the second interesting aspect that is kind of paradigmatically different than HTTP, which is that IPFS is a peer-to-peer networking protocol underneath that addressing system. So you can ask for a file, and instead of saying, hey, internet, help me find this specific server that has this specific file and return it to me, you can say, hey, network, does anybody have this file? And anybody can return that file to you because you can verify that it is exactly what you asked for. So it's very different than HTTP in some very important ways, but it provides a level of resilience that is built in by design that HTTP cannot provide. It allows you to try to at least give us more tools to solve the 404 problem. You know, Juan Bennett, the founder of Protocol Labs and the inventor of these technologies, saw some research from, I think it was the late 90s and then reprised again in the early 2000s around the average lifetime of a web page. At the time, they were like, it was about 90 days or something like that, right? And this idea that this repository of human knowledge, of human experience that is the internet, that is the web, could exist for a very short window of time and then poof, disappear, never to be seen again, is really concerning and was back then and is still today. And so IPFS aims to try to think about what are the characteristics of an internet that we need to be able to make sure that this human experience that we're capturing every day in our digital lives actually can last 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, 100 years, and at least try to solve some of those problems today.
Nice. I remember content addressable storage has been a dream for decades now. The ability to find something and not have to do, I would take it, not have to worry about the specific path or a specific server. And this seems to be moving in that direction. But how do I, as a developer, how do I interact with it? Do I set up an IPFS node on somewhere, if I want outside resources, can I use the IPFS address as the pure resolver? What's going on from the developer's perspective?
Yeah, IPFS is pretty flexible as HTTP is. You know, it doesn't take a lot to stand up an HTTP server, and similarly, it doesn't take a lot to put up an IPFS node. You can install an application called IPFS Desktop to be able to run a node yourself. You can also install IPFS as a CLI. That desktop app installs a CLI, which makes it very easy to work with pretty immediately. But you can also install it from various package managers as well, usually the ones you're most familiar with on the systems that you're developing on. What that does is basically start a daemon that connects to, it bootstraps by connecting to 5 or 6 well-known servers, using those to connect to more and more peers, and then manages a set of persistent connections to those peers over the lifetime of that daemon running. It does that to be able to ensure the best possible chance to be able to have a performant experience in requesting and fetching the data that you're asking for. So it basically manages a minimum set of peers to be able to maximize the number of people that it can ask on the network that might have the data that you're looking for. It uses a DHT, a distributed hash table, to be able to manage and discover who is holding what data on the network. This basically is a cooperative network that is comprised of the aggregate set of peers that are participating at any given time. So as opposed to having kind of a formal relationship or registration system of who is part of the network or who is not part of the network can be comprised by all the participants at any given time. One of the resilience aspects that I think is really interesting, and one of the reasons why I kind of ended up going down the rabbit hole and leaving the old web world, I was at Mozilla for 13 years before jumping into the Web3 world, was the ability of IPFS to be able to use multiple transports to be able to do this type of communication. So instead of being stuck with just HTTP, the libp2p stack underlying IPFS and Filecoin allows you to use things like MDNS on a local network and then a raw TCP socket connection to be able to transfer data between nodes. Nice. So for example, if we're both on the same subnet and the internet goes out, we can still keep collaborating on an editor or a game or whatever it is that we're doing over IPFS, even though we don't have a broader internet connection. So that I think is really powerful from a user agent actually giving you user agency. you can do things then with that protocol that you couldn't if you didn't have a network connection. And that, for me, that type of resilience, like I want to be able to use myself applications that still work if the internet goes out, if I got 20 people in a classroom but no connection at all, or if I'm in a remote place and I want to be able to send you a photo from my phone to your phone. There's nothing technically preventing us from doing that. But when everything's built on HTTP, that remote connection is absolutely necessary for us to actually be able to collaborate together. And that's a shortcoming that I feel like the internet that we all want to have, that it doesn't need to have that shortcoming. And having transport agnostic protocols for exchanging data gives us the ability as application developers to kind of build the apps that we want to see in the world that we want to work that way.
Nice, nice. What sort of networks are you seeing being built on IPFS?
Well, this has definitely been the year of the NFT. I mean, last year, a lot of DeFi, you know, data being addressed on IPFS. Content addressing is really good for addressing data that's going to be in an immutable ledger in a blockchain. So IPFS is pretty popular with blockchain generally, but with NFTs, it became really, really important to be able to have a way to refer to data both from a blockchain, but also in a way that made sure that that data could stay available. So where does an NFT live? Who hosts it? That's a big challenge in the NFT world right now. One of the reasons why IPFS is often used is because content addressing, as opposed to location addressing, means that you can't, as they say, rug pull. You can't actually that remove the data that you quote unquote sold to somebody. You can if it's on IPFS, but anybody else could also still be hosting that data. As we saw when a prominent NFT network went down at the end of last year, and it was basically trivial for other projects to be able to collect all that NFT data, scrape it, publish it to another platform, and immediately stand up replacement platforms for that network. The data was still there. Nothing was lost. In the HTTP world, if that company went out of business, it would be very difficult to retrieve those assets and those files.
Nice. But still a lot more work and a lot less assurance it'll actually be successful, I take it.
Yeah. So one of the goals is just making sure that the data that you and I use when we interact together online can stay online for as long as we need it. That's really a very simple way of thinking about what IPFS gives you both as a developer and as an end user.
All right. Fantastic. Now, when we talk about blockchain, we always talk about it as it's a singular thing, but evidently that's not the case. There are many blockchains. Marco, I was wondering if maybe you could talk, what is the Cosmos Hub that the Interchain Foundation is managing now, and how does that add into this picture?
Yeah, first of all, thanks for having me on the podcast. It's amazing seeing the whole crew because we all work together in some capacities, from starting to integrate libP2P within Tendermint Core, and then also with the Agoric team with IBC and a lot of the research in that world. But basically how the Cosmos Hub is meant to, first of all, the number one and largest use case of the Cosmos Hub right now, I would say, is funding open source development. The Cosmos Hub has enabled many developers to continue development of the core software stack, be it from Consensus, the distributed database that we call Tendermint, all the way up to the application layer where the Cosmos SDK, where users can develop their own blockchain. And this is something that Agoric implores today with their blockchain. But where the Cosmos Hub really comes into play is in this world of Interchain, there's many blockchains. And with many blockchains, you kind of come into this problem of many-to-many connections between these blockchains. On top of this, there's a lot of services to make the UX around many blockchains a lot simpler. And so the Cosmos Hub is meant to be a hub where many packets can be routed through. So instead of one blockchain having to have 500 connections, it can have one singular connection to the Cosmos Hub. And the Cosmos Hub and its servers and its validators can be the people manning all those 500 connections instead of the other network. But on top of this, there's many services. So as we see new chains come on board, there's a lot of overhead that comes into play, from integrating with many third-party providers, integrating with exchanges, integrating with custody providers. There's a whole multitude of things that need to be worked on. But in the long run, since the Cosmos Hub has been around for 2-3 years now, then a lot of this stuff is already in place with the Cosmos Hub. So it's kind of, how can the Cosmos Hub offer this to the wider group of the Interchain? And then on top of this, it's facilitating a lot of this communication between chains.
Terrific. And now, so is this a service? Is it a bit like, what's equivalent in with the internet? Are we talking about gateways, or is it more of a router sort of thing? Or how would I think about it?
Yeah, you can think of it as a router. It's kind of like a service provider to the interchain, to all these blockchains that are coming online, and the many other ecosystems that are joining the inter-blockchain communication standard. So on top of developing a consensus engine and an application framework, the Interchain Foundation also worked towards a inter-blockchain communication standard. And in many ways, you can think of it as like TCP/IP, where the underlying protocol is defined, but not how the messages are, the messages between the blockchains are not defined themselves. And this is really up to the application to develop these messages and how to communicate with other chains. And so providing a lot of this work and providing a lot of messages for users for blockchains to use is kind of up the alley of the Cosmos Hub as well.
The Cosmos Hub will be used by a service provider, do you see? Or would it be, it sounds like it would be outside the individual applications or even blockchains as a third-party service, or how would it work commercially?
Commercially, so we can see it as the Cosmos Hub. Let's say a new blockchain comes online and they need a custody provider. They want to allow their investors to custody their token not within only their wallet, but possibly within an exchange like Coinbase or something. Well, the on-ramp to integrate Coinbase can be very steep, and it really depends on Coinbase's timeline if they can integrate. And so in this sense, the Cosmos Hub could be a way for these new applications to integrate directly into Coinbase a lot sooner than a one-year timeline that would be projected in the normal world. So this is kind of like a single use case. Another use case is kind of this chain registry, chain name service. So with many chains in the ecosystem coming on, I believe there's upwards of 20, 25 new chains just within the Cosmos ecosystem that have come up in the last year and a half. Well, now with all these chains, there's a lot of overhead to like managing which chain, how do I join a chain? How do I run a node there? How do I join the network there? And so the Cosmos Hub being able to provide a centralized way to find this information that is updated in real time is a very big need for this ecosystem. And kind of having the Cosmos Hub be the provider of this information could be very important.
Nice. Roland, can you have some experience in the chain launching part of this conversation?
Yeah. I think it's worth it, you know, just as from the perspective of a chain launching in the Cosmos ecosystem, how do we think about the Cosmos Hub? Because again, we're a separate blockchain, but I think what's really important is thinking about how network effects affect the entire blockchain ecosystem. And so as a new application or a new chain, if we launched in some external, did our own thing world, we'd be sort of launching in a vacuum, right? We'd have nobody to connect to. There'd be no assets that can easily come to our chain to use whatever financial services we could build and deploy. By launching in the Cosmos ecosystem, there is the large set of assets, which are atoms, which are the native token of the Cosmos Hub, which are available as sort of backstop support that could come in and use services that we could provide, that potentially with interchain security potentially launching this year could help actually secure our chain. And there's sort of a lot of considerations like that which allow a new chain to launch in sort of a vibrant ecosystem with the hub as sort of this shelling point of everybody's kind of paying attention to the ecosystem in general, and the hub is the magnet for that attention and can help direct and build new services out the way Marco is saying. You know, it's sort of different from Web 2, where it's like you build a service and people may or may not use it. The hub is really kind of the leader of what happens within the Cosmos space.
Nice. All right, fantastic. We have to wrap up in a minute or two, but I did want to ask, for the hobbyist developer who wants to jump into this space, what's some low-hanging fruit? What are some applications? What are some markets? What are some use cases they should take a look at? Establish a foothold in this frontier, so to speak.
At least from my front, I would say it can look like a daunting step to jump into crypto. But from personal experience, like myself, I'm a self-taught programmer. I came in through the front end world and then ended up doing consensus engine work. I would say just getting your feet wet and just coming in and taking the current knowledge you do have is an amazing first step. The amount of applications, the amount of things that you can build is really limitless. It's really up to your imagination. And within the, if you want to be forward facing, if you want to be more client UI front end developer, if you want to be more in the back end, kind of like solving really interesting architectural and consensus issues, there's really room for everyone. And there's room for everyone to grow into a position that they want to be. It's just, it can seem daunting from the outside, but once you get inside, it's actually very friendly. Everyone's very supportive.
Excellent. Roland, how about you? What's your take?
Yeah, I mean, I would echo that. And I would also say, at least for working on Agoric, the best way to engage with us is to go to Gitcoin and find some bounties. You know, we put bounties out every couple of weeks or so, which tend to be sort of bite-sized things that we would pay an external developer to do. You get direct access to the engineering team here, and we can help you through the Agoric stack and make sure that you can understand how to write a smart contract and deploy it on Agoric. And, you know, a lot of other chains or organizations do bounties as well. And that can be a good way to get your feet wet.
Nice. Dietrich, what do you see?
Yeah, I think generally one of the things that's super unique about this whole new space is that it's something that emerged after JavaScript was already basically the top programming language for many, many years. And given that there is, you know, an estimated 25 million developers in the world, and they estimate that over 12 million of those build websites.
Huh.
Almost all of these projects have JavaScript SDKs, and that makes entry really, really easy for people to explore and learn using the tools that they know, and oftentimes sometimes even the frameworks that they know. For IPFS specifically, you can install an IPFS node today. IPFS desktop makes it really easy. Brave browser has support for a native IPFS node that you can turn on inside the browser and publish a web page. Put your blog on IPFS. I did it. There are services like Pinata and Fleek, which make it very, very easy. Fleek even integrates into the existing kind of, you know, GitHub Actions and CI that you're used to. Integrates with a bunch of static site frameworks that you've already probably used before. Very, very easy to get started and put your own web page and your personal presence on Web3 today.
All right, perfect. So JavaScript developers, you have a new weekend project. All right, Margo, Roland, and Dietrich, thank you so much for taking time to get us up to speed. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. And we'll see you in the next episode of the New Stack Makers.
Thanks for listening. Subscribe on Simplecast to listen to more episodes on the New Stack Makers. Create and share your favorite audiogram using our Simplecast player. For more articles and great stories, go to thenewstack.io.